Hello and welcome to the Music Retailers Podcast. I'm your host, Donovan Bankhead, and together you and I are going to listen to and learn from some of my favorite instrumental music retailers, manufacturers, well, anyone else that I think would be interesting. My goal is to provide a podcast where you can learn something new in every episode.
At Springfield Music, we started using Merchant Cost Consulting earlier this year. These guys are former banking and credit card reps who go and negotiate your processing rates on your behalf. Now, like most of you, we're pretty aggressive about shopping our processing rate around, so I wasn't sure they'd be able to save us much money. But boy, was I wrong. On average, they're saving us about $600 a month. The deal is we split it 50-50 with them for so many months, and after that, all the savings are ours to keep. Plus, they keep an eye on your fees during this time to make sure those freaking credit card processors don't find a way to jack up your rate again. They're good folks, and they do what they say they do. Actually, in our case, they underpromised and over-delivered. They estimated about $500 a month in savings, and it's been closer to $600. When you contact Patrick at Merchant Cost Consulting, tell him that Donovan Bankhead sent you. This does two things. One, they will pay me a slight referral commission. But more importantly, two, you'll get 10% off of your first month's bill if you choose to go with them after their free analysis. Listen, I wouldn't recommend it to you if it wasn't worth it. It'll only take a few minutes of your time. They handle the rest. Contact Patrick McClellan. His email is patrick@merchantcostconsulting.com. P-A-T-R-I-C-K at merchantcostconsulting.com. I'll even give you a cell phone number, 508-733-7622. And remember, tell them that Donovan sent you. So my guest today on the Music Retail Podcast is Lee Anderton from Anderton's Music. And Anderton's Music is, I had to look this up because I'm familiar with the company and the store and through the YouTube channel, but I wasn't sure where in England is located, but your store is located in Guildford, England. Lee, welcome to Music Retail Podcast. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
When I started recording the podcast with Lee, we kind of immediately started talking about how our business had been affected by COVID and how it affected Anderton's before I actually even started, like, launched into the podcast. So right here, I'm going to insert that conversation.
Stuff happening. Others didn't, you know, just kind of depended on the city that we were in, because we operate in four different cities. In two different states. And so each municipality would have their own rules. So some were more strict than others, and we just had to follow the protocols based off of that. But we were able to open pretty quick. I mean, and we're still back to, I mean, we're open now. And other than wearing masks, I would say we're, you know, kind of back to normal. Is that not the way things are in the UK?
I think we had two different ones. So the online side of the business, the part of the business that isn't open to the public, traded continuously all the way through. So we didn't have any restrictions that forced us to close. Lots of restrictions that made it a challenge, but none that forced us to close. The walk-in business, you know, the part of the business that's open to the general public, has probably only been, well, I mean, that hasn't been properly open for over a year now. And on the, I want to say, maybe 10 weeks or so out of the, maybe 10 or 15 weeks out of the last 52 that it has been allowed to be open, the restrictions on which, you know, the restrictions on how many people can be in the store, what they're allowed to touch, what we have to do with products that they've touched, you know, the whole kind of thing, has honestly meant that it's, I want to say, sometimes it's more expensive to try and be open than it is just to close during those periods.
Sure.
We're in a lucky position that when we came into lockdown, about 80% of our turnover was online anyway. And that some months during lockdown actually doubled. So even with the store closed, we didn't have a single month where we weren't 30 or 40% up on the previous year. So we've had our best year of trading ever. And actually, this whole grand reopening of the store this week for us, which, because it's from this Monday that the restrictions on non-essential retail were lifted, has been a bit of a, like, because we still have to open with all of the restrictions around social distancing. So to be honest with you, from our point of view, we're a bit like, you know, we're back to that kind of crap opening.
Yeah. Yeah.
That we'd almost rather not do.
Yeah.
Hey ho. I mean, on the flip side, it does appear that, it does appear that the UK is, we vaccinated 50% of the population, pretty much, 99% of the vulnerable population is vaccinated now. So, new cases are falling
That's
rapidly.
Impressive.
And the number of people who are dying every day is still sad, but it's down to a couple of dozen rather than 1,000 or 2,000 that it was in
sure.
its peak, So,
yeah, when you start getting into those types of numbers, I mean, that's becomes, flu like numbers, less than car crashes. Like, you're getting into sort of the normal amount of risk that we accept for, going
it's a bit
out
morbid,
in the world.
Isn't it? And I think, I've been lucky that none of my family, I didn't lose any members of my family. I had an uncle that had it sick, but wasn't hospitalized. And I don't really know anyone. So I think I'm slightly uncomfortable with sort of, sometimes I can feel my language being quite blasé about, oh, it's okay, because not that many people are dying, but I suppose at the end of the day, if it's your mum or your dad, then one person dying is awful.
Yeah, it certainly is. I think we have to temper our thoughts, though, with recognizing that we just accept certain amounts of risk for all kinds of activities. If we had this idea that if we truly believed the things that we said, that we cherish human life above everything else, above ease of life, economic gain, whatever, then we wouldn't drive cars, we wouldn't have swimming pools, we wouldn't have these
things. You're right.
And so it's always a bit of an analysis, but I think we always want to do what we can to take reasonable precautions to safeguard that. And the United States, the biggest issue we have is, we've been given guidance that tells us that if all parties are to be masked, that our chance of transmitting this disease to one another is very little, it's very low. And we have people that don't want to even be burdened with something like that, and I don't have much tolerance for that kind of carelessness for your fellow man. And I had said before, when all this was happening kind of last year, I said, a silver lining for this could be that if we destigmatize the idea of wearing a mask in public, if you're ill, because it was funny, in December of 2019, I had watched a YouTube video. I'd kind of got into this YouTube rabbit hole, probably after watching an Anderton's video of a day in the life of a Japanese blah. And, a Japanese salesperson, Japanese office worker, Japanese auto mechanic, whatever. And one of the episodes, they talked about why Japanese people wore masks. And I always just assumed it's because they were germophobes and they didn't want to catch other people's germs. And they were and the guy said, there are some people that do that, but the vast majority, they do it because they don't want to spread the germs that they have in case that they woke up that morning feeling a little under the weather. And because in Japan, everyone's so packed on top of each other, they're just much more considerate of their fellow citizen. And so if one felt like they might be under the weather, and needed to go out, then they'd wear a mask. And I thought, boy, that would be so cool if we could do that in the United States, but we would never do that. We would never wear a mask when we go out in public. And then, of course, only a couple of months later, all of the pandemic started, and now wearing a mask in public is totally acceptable. So hopefully, if in the future, if people have to go out, it'd be great if they're sick, if they stay home, but sometimes you don't have that option. Sometimes you have to go refill a prescription, go to a doctor or whatever. Maybe we can normalize people wearing masks and getting each other sick less often, passing the cold less often, the flu less. I mean, I live in America, so our chance of being considerate for a fellow man is probably not very high.
I was going to say, what are the chances in America of normalizing anything?
That's true.
Hey ho, hey ho.
I can dream. I can dream. I want to hear the story of how and when Anderton's got started.
Sure. Well, for that, you've got to go all the way back to the 60s, where my grandfather and my father were both keen drummers. And off the back of that sort of British pop explosion, decided that opening a music shop would be a cool idea. My grandfather was in the police in London, and my dad had worked in music shops for a couple of years straight out of school. So between the age of like 16 and 18 years old, he'd worked in a music store, got some valuable experience, made some contacts. And then when they decided to do it, Guildford, which is about 25 miles south of London, was my grandmother's hometown. So there was a sense of kind of moving back closer to where some of my grandmother's family were. Mm-hmm. And they opened a little shop. My grandfather would have been in his 50s and my dad was 18. And I know fairly quickly it became quite apparent that the two had quite different aspirations for the store. So granddad thought it would just be a cool place to hang with his music, you know, his buddies, his music buddies, and maybe it would make enough money to keep a roof over the family. And my dad, I think naturally at that age, was far more ambitious. So well before I was on the scene, even before I was born, I think that relationship was tense and certainly was something that my father and I made a conscious effort not to try and allow sort of history to repeat itself. Because I think any family business comes with ups and downs, you know, the downs largely being how sometimes the entire relationship becomes consumed within the workplace and isn't yep. allowed to really sort of blossom outside of it. Anyway, so that was the store, and the store was, you know, I want to say sort of reasonably successful. My at one point in the 70s, my dad had three branches of Anderton's, all still in the southeast of England. And by this time, I think, yeah, by the back end of the 70s, my granddad was sort of out of it. You know, my dad had worked out that deal. He'd done that deal with him to sort of get him to retire and take a back seat. And then I think kind of bizarrely, my dad lost interest, I think, in the music industry. He's very, very entrepreneurial, my dad, and always looking for, you know, other things to do. And I think at that time he felt that it had just reached a ceiling where there was just more exciting opportunities to go and do other stuff. So he had a furniture manufacturing business at one point, and he'd sort of left Anderton's really. And there was a really lovely guy called John Hulk, but big guy as well. Brilliant surname for a guy who's like 6'6" and massive as well. So, and so when I started working for the store in my summer holidays, when I was 14 or 15 years old, so you're sort of talking now sort of mid to late 80s, I suppose, I never really saw my dad in the store. He was sort of, he still owned it, but he'd put in this guy, John Hulk, who'd been with us many years, and sort of said, look, it's your baby. You do what you want to do with it. And that's fine by me. So I think I was quite lucky there, because I even from day one, I was really conscious not to make a big deal of my dad owning the store. So that would absolutely be advice number one. If your mum or dad does own the store and you start working there as a junior, just don't throw your surname around, or, you know what, it's like, just be the, and that's what I did. I was like, if any of the sales guys needed boxes getting from somewhere, or they needed a cup of tea, or I just tidied up. So I just came in right, and I didn't care. I just enjoyed it. And then I don't know why, I was a pretty bright kid in school up to the age of sort of 16, passed all my exams without really trying. I think I felt my destiny was probably to go to college and then university. And I don't really know at that time whether I really felt I wanted to be in the store. I don't, you know, it's hard to remember. I know I loved doing it, but wasn't necessarily, you know, you have to remember as well, at the time, this is a business that had three or four members of staff. You know, there was no sense I was joining like an empire or anything like that. It was just a little family business. My dad had closed, by the way, the two of the three branches that he had. So we were back to one branch.
Back to one store. And what year roughly is this? What time period?
This is by probably, again, early 80s, maybe mid to late 80s again, around about the same time. I think he was just basically going whichever store he... Yeah, he honestly he'd lost interest in it. And none of the other stores were big stores. It was like three little stores. And I think he just went, oh, why don't we just have one slightly more focused store with a bit more investment in it than three not very exciting stores. Anyway, I don't know why, but my college education was a disaster. I completely disengaged with education. I didn't go for over a year, even though I was telling my parents that I was going. And then when they found out, particularly when my dad found out, it was like the mother of all sort of parental explosions occurred. And I just didn't really know what I wanted to do. I think I just sort of said to my dad, I don't know anymore what I want to do. You know, can I just work in the shop, please? And I think he was ever so disappointed, because I think at that time, he just felt it wasn't a great career. It was a sort of a lifestyle choice to have a music shop back then. And if you were kind of into the gear and you did a bit of gigs and you might earn a bit of pin money, but it was no, you know, it wasn't really the sense it was this going to be this amazing business. And so he, you know, I think he gave me a very, very stern telling off and told me that I'd earn the most ludicrously low weekly wage and gave me a mop or whatever and kicked me out of his office. And I started sort of there and then. And I, so this will be around about, I guess, 1989, something like that, 88, 89, maybe, yeah, 89. But that was it. I loved it. And I just fell into my stride and I learned to play the guitar because, you know, I was surrounded by these musical instruments and I kind of helped. I was becoming more and more capable of being a salesperson. And I think I was young and enthusiastic. And I think customers responded well to that. And then I feel like I almost want to condense the next 10 years into, once my dad had realized that I was into this. So after a year or two of me being there, I think he did, in fairness, do he did something pretty amazing, which was to move the store to somewhere substantially bigger, almost as a, look, if you want to give this a try, I think I want to make something that you could at least try and make interesting and special.
Yeah.
So he moved us to a new location that was, I think, probably was about four times the size of the old location. And I know he put a lot on the line. He mortgaged his house again to do it. And, you know, he was buying property. So I suppose to a certain extent, I think he probably at the back of his mind always knew that if it all went completely pear-shaped, you know, there was a property deal off the back of it to be done. But anyway, so we moved in and then I just was into it and I was bringing ideas to the business that I felt, I think some stars aligned. There was round about that time, the customer base for musical instruments was beginning to shift from, you know, long in the tooth, tired professional musicians that just needed to go and buy stuff to do their trade to this lifestyle idea that people were going, oh, do you know, I had a crack at playing the guitar when I was 15 in the 60s, but, you know, work and family has got in the way. But now I'm, you know, 50 or whatever they might have been by then. They're going,
right,
maybe I might just get back into it. But those customers didn't want to shop in the kind of crappy music store that maybe the old fashioned professional musician was comfortable in. So I think I was bringing ideas to the table going, look, we should smarten this up and we should kind of wear uniforms and we should focus on how displays look. And we shouldn't, you know, if we're going to have 100 guitars on display, we shouldn't have like 50 different brands and two of each. You know, we should have, if Fender's the aspirational brand, can we have like 30 or 40 Fenders on the wall in a sense that there's a range there? And can we do the same with Yamaha or whatever it was? And I know I met a little bit of resistance from both other staff and customers. Actually, I've met a lot of resistance from the trade, you know, reps going, who is this young whippersnapper here telling me that he's not going to give me an order this week? And I remember we introduced rep appointments So like we just said to reps, you can't just turn up.
Yeah.
You know, and it took years to stop reps turning up. And we upset so many reps because we just used to say, well, you didn't make an appointment. I'm not seeing you. They'd be like, well, I've just driven for 2 hours to get here. You know, I always see you. It's like, I don't care. I'm busy doing something else. You know, it's like,
we did it sounds silly. That used to be the common thing that reps would just show up whenever they felt like it. And you were supposed to stop everything to talk with them. And we stopped doing that in, you know, early 2000s.
Yeah,
because it just was such a time waste.
I've got, you know, I remember one rep who I'm friends with, you know, I mean, I love him, as in he's a bit old, you know, quite a bit older than me, but he would come in with this accessory catalog like this thick and just elbow his way up to the counter and slap the catalog down, you know, and you're just going, hang on, I'm literally trying to sell this guy something here. But anyway, so I would say by the end of the 90s, we'd established ourselves as something more than just, you know, a little music store. You know, we were a little bit more on the map. We probably got to a turnover of £3-4 million a year, something like that, maybe 10 or 15 staff. You know, there was a sense that we were probably three times bigger than we were at the beginning of that decade in terms of a business. We'd enjoyed a lot of success off the back of that digital revolution in home recording. You know, gone are the days of Roland delivering 8-track digital recorders for £2,500 each and selling 50 of them in a day, you know, which was. So then at the end of the 90s, the next project that I sort of got involved in. And I should say as well that the other thing during the 90s, I've got two business partners that I work with now, Stuart and Beverly, who also started working then, and Stuart before Beverly, but I don't want this to be like, oh, it's all about me driving things forward. You know, we were very lucky. We had some amazing people and two of those amazing people are still with us in partnership sort of capacity. So I think, anyway, shared a vision. We had this sort of mantra, which I still think we have today. We're not very good at business planning here, or at least I don't think the three of us are terribly good at strategic long-term business planning, but we're always coming in going, what can we do today better than we did yesterday? You know, what is there about the business, big project or a small project, that we can just do better than we've done before?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not suggesting that that's a better way of running your business, but when you've got that attitude and mentality, with or without strategic planning, you know, you are generally, I think, you know, your business will get better and be better and be more successful. So about 2000, I did kind of drive through the first electronic stock management system that the business had ever had. And that was amazing. So all of a sudden staff could take a customer inquiry about, have you got a certain item and how much is it? And they could actually look it up on a computer rather than having to run around the store trying to find out whether we had something. And it certainly made reordering products much easier and began that slight shift where we weren't reliant on a rep coming around to tell us what we'd run out of. You know, we were managing our own stock inventory much better. And that began to open up the mail order business to us. So all of a sudden you could have a phone call with someone going, yeah, I'm looking for an XYZ. Have you got one? And you could very quickly manage that inquiry with the stock control system and the sales order system that was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of got into mail order. And that started to make up a not massive, but, you know, 10-20% of our turnover. And this sense that, okay, you don't have to be in Scotland to sell something to someone in Scotland. You know, we can be in Guildford and sell. And I think that was quite a pivotal moment for me as well, because all through the 90s, particularly probably the second half of the 90s, it was like, what am I going to do? You know, what, do I open another branch and another branch and another branch? And as soon as that mail order bug kind of, well, bug is the wrong word, but that sense that, oh, okay, perhaps we can grow our reach without necessarily having more stores. That for me was a big one. I absolutely, if I didn't have to, I didn't see myself driving between 4, 5, 6 different stores trying to work out why each one wasn't performing how you hoped it would. And I wanted all of our best people and all of our effort to go into the one location and to just make it the best that we could make it. And then again, fairly quickly after we put the electronic stock control system in, probably 2003, something like that, we went online, kind of pretty archaic technology now. And I literally remember that sense that, you know, every time an order drop came in on the internet, it might only be like one a day or something. You'd just be like, oh my God, somebody's ordered something on the internet. You know, it's amazing. And that technology, you know, we were pretty early adopters of most of the sort of new technology online through that sort of period of the noughties. And then 2009 or 2010, I forget, we started, I guess, what we're probably have become most famous for, you know, the YouTube thing, which was, even that I remember now, I'd already, by the back end of the noughties, I wasn't on the sales floor anymore. I was very much an office-based person within Anderton's. I should also say that throughout this whole time, if anyone's wondering where my dad is, you know, he was definitely there as the sort of the fiscal purse holder of, you know, like the main guy that just was going, look, you know, I don't think we're going to do the numbers this month, or maybe we are, or, you know, I am going to sanction this big order or I'm not. But he wasn't there. He certainly wasn't frontline dictating where we go or anything like that. But So round about this. So by the end of the noughties, my dad had retired. So I suppose.
I got to stop you real quick and say, I've never heard anyone describe it as the noughties.
Do you not say that in America? We say, no. So we go 90s, noughties. So it's the noughties, as in, not because we're naughty, but because all of the
right
start of the century is all in the noughts, isn't it?
So, yeah. I love that. Okay. It's first I've heard that.
Sorry, everybody. Yes, we didn't have a period of being naughty, although perhaps we should have. So I was in this kind of finding my feet, I think, in this slightly more strategic role of going, what are we doing? Where are we going? And I just remember seeing the Pro Guitar Shop videos with Andy from Pro Guitar Shop, and I don't think I've ever met face to face, but yeah, he, you know, I owe a lot to his early videos, because I watched them and I went, wow, that is a massively more engaging way of selling a product online than just putting a picture up and writing a paragraph about it.
Yeah.
So quite quickly, I started hanging out on YouTube a bit more, and it was pretty easy to discover Rob Chapman, because he was, again, pretty much the only guy really doing what he was doing back then. And I know it sounds a bit daft, but I don't think his phone number was on his YouTube channel. Maybe it was just his email address, but I just contacted him. So I either emailed him or I got his phone number and I phoned him, and we had this conversation, and he was based about 2 or 3 hours drive from Guildford. And so he said, look, I'll come up. And it was really funny, because on YouTube, Rob is just like this crazy sort of mad, doesn't take himself too seriously, funny guy. But when I met him, he was super serious. And I was like, you know, I'm a marketing executive. I know what we're doing, and we're going to have a plan. It's going to be a strategy. And I'm going to go, okay, great. We're going to have a plan. It's going to be a strategy. It's like, yes, this is grown up businessman talk. And so we started doing videos, and they were just, it was just chaos. Like everything, we would just mess around and nothing went to plan. And this idea that we'd make a video of something and we'd sell 50 of them or 20, we didn't sell anything that we videoed at all. It was just a complete waste of time like that. But we were enjoying ourselves, having fun. And about 6 months in, I was only doing probably one or two videos a month with Rob at that time. But about 6 months in, I'm just going, look, this is a good laugh, but it's not bringing any business in. It is just a waste of time. I think I'll just knock it on the head. But I just started to see the odd email coming into the store going, I've just bought this XYZ from you. I know it's nothing that you've ever videoed, but I just enjoy watching you. So I thought I'd give you a bit of custom as a way of saying thank you for the videos you do. And I literally, it was like, bam, like that's what we can do with the YouTube channel. It's all about engaging at some intangible sense. So it's not QVC, which is what I thought originally was what I thought it could be. And if anything, I think, you know, those early Pro Guitar Shop videos were a bit QVC, you know, it was a bit pretty straight, pretty much all about a product demonstration and all about hoping at the end of it that you would buy that product. And it was just like, bam, that was it. And it gave me and Rob and then all the other presenters that I've worked with over the years and that relationship, obviously, that's blossomed with people like Danish Pete, just a different, you know, it's not about doing product demonstrations in the hope that at the end of the demonstration, somebody clicks and buys that. It's about going, you love music. We love music. Let's just have some fun with it. And if right. you can have some fun watching us having fun, and maybe it's a bit informative, hopefully more than just a bit informative, you know, hopefully there's some underlying element of going, oh, that was interesting. And definitely there's honesty. You know, we are not here to just tell you everything's great and please buy everything. We're certainly here to be constructively critical about products, if that's appropriate. But mostly it's fun. You know, mostly, well, you and I have met, albeit briefly, a few years ago, and I got the sense that, you know, you were probably of a similar sense. You know, it's like, it's fun, right? If you don't know, you know, when I first met Donovan, we were at a NAMM on stage doing some NAMM Q&A, and at 8 o'clock
the
in the morning,
show.
Donovan bought me out a 4-pack of beer, and we cracked open the beer and sung the God Save the Queen, I think, didn't we? In front of 1,000 people at 8 o'clock in the morning. But
you know what was funny about that? Well, I mean, of course, the whole thing's funny, but I had gotten the idea a couple of weeks before of buying gifts for each of the panelists. And I think the idea came because the year before I had done this, given this pair of a leather thong to Alan Friedman. And so the next time I thought, like, well, this will be my thing. Like, I'll give gifts to everyone. And so I was looking for gifts, and I remember Chris Sos, I think his name is. He was a purchaser for Musician's Friend, and I think he's still there. And I think they had announced that they were having some financial troubles or something like that. And so I got him an abacus, which probably in hindsight wasn't really the kindest gift to give to someone. But I had, and these are just cheap gifts I found off Amazon, and I found this camo fanny pack thing that would hold cans.
It was like a tool belt, wasn't it?
It was designed to hold like koozies for canned beverages. And so I bought that, and that was all I had. And me and my guys, we were driving in that morning to do the panel. And I was telling them how I have these gifts, and they're all kind of laughing. And one of the guys speaks up and he says, you should stop and get beer for that, like, and get Budweiser, because it's, you know, like the American beer. And he's like, matter of fact, if you get Bud and Bud Light, it'll be red, white, and blue. And I was like, oh my God, that's hysterical. So we pull over into that 7-Eleven that's right across from the NAMM show and run inside. And it's, you know, it's 7 in the morning at this point. We're grabbing beer and put it in there. And oh my gosh, yeah, you made that so funny, because I had kind of had this thing in my head worked up talking about like how you're in America now and, you know, you got to drink the king of beers. And I had doing this whole kind of redneck thing. And then you just had that perfect line where you, like, you came up, you open it, you pop open the beer, you're like, God save the queen. And like, we cheered, drank it.
It
was just perfect.
It does always matter. I mean, I think you guys, when I say you guys, I mean Americans, I think you do retail so unbelievably professionally. But sometimes it's all a bit too serious. You know, it's like it is. I mean, I don't think British people could do retail as seriously and professionally as American people do retail. And I think any British person that's been to America will know exactly what I mean. And they won't be offended by what I've said. But I think we blend humor with our business better in a way that I think American people don't. Yeah, it's like the number of conversations I've had with, you know, American suppliers over what we say and what we do in our videos. They're like, why would you do that? Why did you say that? You know, it's like, well, I don't know. Why wouldn't we say that? Because it's funny. And they're like, yeah, but you just probably convinced someone not to buy something that maybe they were going to. And you're just like, so they'll buy something else. You know, it's just
right.
Like, anyway, but so back to the YouTube thing, obviously that's gone bonkers. But I think, again, the underlying thing behind that was if anything, I wouldn't say YouTube was the easy bit, but it probably was the easy bit, to be fair. You know, doing that, getting a relatively small number of people to sit in front of a camera and mess around with guitars every day, it's not that difficult, to be honest. I mean, I think there's a magic that you can't control that you just have to hope happens. So it's not a very formulaic approach to making videos. There's a lot of just like, I hope this works. But what it does, you know, the bit that is really hard work and has taken crazy amounts of investment and clever people over the last 10 years is to put an infrastructure in place so that when you've got millions of people watching your YouTube channel who go, oh, that's cool, let me see if I can buy something, or I'll interact with that business. Maybe I'll send them a question, or I'll order something off the internet, or you've got to deliver, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've spent millions over the last 10 years on infrastructure. So, you know, the right e-commerce technology, the right people running it, the right warehouse management software. You know, there's in excess of $10 million worth of stock sitting there waiting to go out so that when someone, or you know, and it's like there's a glossy, fun exterior to this business.
Sure.
That I think everybody enjoys being a part of.
But behind, there's real that, work going on in the yeah, background. Yeah.
Behind
yeah.
that, you know, is a proper business, you know, that,
right.
that says, oh yeah, this is, and it's full of systems and processes and great people and, you know, experts in this field and that field to go, yep. Thank you very much for watching the two silly guys on YouTube. And thank you very much for placing the order with us. Now the professional bit kicks in, you know, and we will actually look after you all the way through and look after the problems you've had and blah, 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 blah. But so that's been, I often feel like that there's a lot of focus on us being silly and not enough, you know, Anderson's has now over 150 employees and
wow.
you know, we'll turn over in excess of probably $70 million this year out of its one site.
Holy cow.
So yeah, there's no, please. It's like I said, I 100%, there are lots and lots of very serious professional people working in Anderson's that you never get to see. You just get to see a handful of us being silly, and maybe not silly all the time, but yeah, that's the, and that growth, you know, most of that growth has come in the last 10 years. And that's been unbelievably challenging to manage, you know, three different warehouse moves in 10 years, a fourth one happening this year, massive number of new staff, massive adoption of new technologies, processes, but in quite a gratifying way, and still in a way that, you know, as successful as I see Anderton's being, you know, we're not even a Sweetwater and Toman and Guitar Center would poop out an Anderton's every weekend, I expect. You know, it's just like we're I know, you know, it's like I totally appreciate that there are substantially bigger MI businesses than us who've grown rapidly over a similar amount of time as well.
I spoke with Chuck Shurick last year for the podcast, and he told me that, you know, and this was right at, a lot of things were still shut down and everyone was still kind of concerned about what was going to happen with our business. And Sweetwater was starting to see, they were seeing orders come through because there was some stimulus money and things like that. But everyone thought maybe that could be short lived. And Sweetwater was so short staffed that Chuck was actually in the warehouse helping to ship orders. And he shared with me that, you know, their goal for 2020, when they had set the financial goal before the pandemic occurred, was to do $1 billion in revenue that year. And I haven't heard, I'm sure it's been published, but I haven't heard it yet. But I would imagine they ended up exceeding that. Which for an independent single location business in our little tiny industry to do $1 billion is unbelievable. So yeah, I say that to say that 70 million is a significant amount.
Yeah.
It's not what they would poop out in a weekend.
Like, well, that's you know what I mean? I mean, we've got the same, you know, over here. We've not in the UK, but in Europe, you know, Toman, which is, you know, it's a, I don't think anybody in Europe does retail in the same way that you guys in America, not saying better or worse or whatever like that, but it's not literally a blueprint of Sweetwater. It's got its own vibe and its own style and flavor. But yeah, when it just comes down to numbers at the end of the day, I think those guys did €1 billion this year, you know, and the euro is pretty much a dollar. So, you know, I'm sure that the size yeah. of, and the, you know, 1100 members of staff, and it's like, I don't know. I have to sometimes put myself back to that guy that was sort of 18, 19 years old in Anderton's, where we were probably doing $10,000 a week, you know, and going, wow, this is hard. You know, it's like, right. we're busy, you know? Yeah. And then it's just mad. I think I remember, and again, it's sometimes it's the speed of change. We had a Black Friday event. So we're miles behind you in terms of how mature Black Friday is over here. But for about the last 5 years, Amazon have been banging that Black Friday drum, and it's become a little bit more part of that retail furniture now. You know, this idea that Black Friday is going to be an event in the UK. And I think about 3 years ago, we had our first kind of real heavy, busy Black Friday. And I remember getting to the end of the Friday and going, wow, we've just sold more in a day than what we sold in the first whole year that I worked at Anderton's, you know, and you're going like, wow, I don't even, what do you even say? It's just like,
yeah,
where does it go? That's just because there are thousands and thousands more people into making music now than there were back then, but it's still quite a feat of logistics, you know.
It is. And there's likely also fewer places for them to go. And you're earning a larger amount of the lion's share of that business than you would have before.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be in our town where I live, there used to be a half dozen music stores here. And we still have quite a few. I mean, we still have 4 major stores in this medium-sized town, and they're all NAMM top 100 stores. That still feels like quite a bit to me. Whereas I think in like my location in Kansas City, which Kansas City is probably 10 times the size of the town that I live in, I think there's maybe a half dozen stores. So, there's not that much more for a much bigger population. And I would imagine you've seen the same thing in the UK of fewer neighborhood music shops and more consolidation.
I don't think you can. You need to understand, I think, the geography of the UK versus the geography of America. There is no sense that we have these big, dense population centers and then 200 miles until the next dense. You know, mm-hmm. it's just the whole of the UK is packed full of people living there. So you're probably talking about 40-50% of the UK's population probably lives within a 3-hour drive of Anderton's. You know, it's like there's no sense that it's that spread out. But equally, I think the UK has been one of the world's leading adopters of online. So because there's so many people living in the UK and traffic in lots of parts of America is a nightmare as well. But I think there's definitely been a sense that people have started to go, I can't be bothered to go to the shops. You know, it's just way, way easier to just buy online. So you're right. If you look at there's probably half a dozen businesses now in the UK, music businesses doing 60-70% of the turnover of the UK and MI. Although again, I don't know, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think the big stores sell a wide range of stuff, or the big businesses. I think there are some very successful mid-sized businesses that heavily specialize in a certain type of instrument, could be vintage guitars or very high-end guitars or pianos or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I just think there are hundreds and hundreds of these very small shops, you know, usually single person owned and managed shops. And that's a lifestyle choice for those people. You know, they're never going to earn, you know, they're going to earn the same kind of money. They could just go and work in a supermarket if they really wanted to, but they love it and they like the lifestyle, and they're to a certain extent, I suppose, a little bit more in control of their destiny. And I don't think those stores will ever go away. You know, I mean, they're part of the fabric, I think, of most town centers, but they're never going to grow to be bigger than what they are. Not some may, I suppose. There'll always be a few with the right amount of drive and determination and luck. But I think most will just, they'll stay that size, and the owners will do it for as long as they're having fun doing it. But it'll be a choice because they like doing it, not because it's financially super rewarding or anything.
Right. So in terms of your day-to-day, you know, we heard in the beginning it was pushing a mop and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's obviously changed drastically now. Give me a sense of what your day-to-day looks like today.
Yeah.
And maybe feel free to kind of contrast between if pre-COVID and today, maybe give you a little sense mm-hmm. of both, so we get a sense of what you'll be going back to once COVID is over.
So I think one of the reasons I've managed to stay so motivated about working at Anderson's over the last, even long, 10 years, you know, 15 years, because I'll be in my 30th year of working at Anderson's next year, this year, maybe even this year. And I'm incredibly fortunate in that I've managed to find people who want to work with me and do all the things that I don't like doing. So, and I kind of feel that from a motivational point of view, and maybe this is, again, useful advice for other people hearing this, it's like, if you've got parts of the job that you hate doing, but you have to do them, you know, if it's your business and there's no one else to do them, the buck ultimately stops with you. If you can find other people that are happy to do that role, like doing it, whatever, and your business can afford to employ them, then 1,000,000% do that. You know, it's like, and just because if you can just mm-hmm. focus on doing the bits you enjoy, you're going to be way happier and more motivated doing it. So I'm very fortunate that I'm in that position. So I still have a fairly big hand in the guitar category here. So in terms of what the brands that we deal with and some of the bigger deals that we do, I'll still be, and some of the new products that we find and things, that'll still be, you know, that's part of my role. Although there's a fantastic purchasing team that I work with who will, you know, do the sort of day to day and pick up the, you know, the auto contribute cool ideas to that sort of pot as well. I work mainly with our e-commerce team rather than the in-store retail team. For Anderton's, in the last 3 or 4 years, the culture has very much changed from, you know, we don't see ourselves as a store with an e-commerce business, you know, part of it. We see ourselves as an e-commerce business with a store that's part of it. And I think we take some of the core ethos about what makes the store great, or what made this, you know, what over the 60 odd years that we've been here, 56 years, what is it that about Anderton's that's made it sort of an enduring success? And a lot of that ties back to the sort of philosophy and the ethos within the store. So the store is not an afterthought. It's a, you know, it's a really core beating heart of the business. But I think now we're beginning to make decisions. In the past, we'd be looking at a decision and we'd go, right, if we do this on the website, it'll have a detrimental impact to the store experience. Therefore, don't do it. And I think as we're coming out the other side of COVID and having really been almost entirely e-commerce related focus for the last 12 months, and the reality is for the next year or so, I don't see the store contributing more than probably 10% of the turnover, if that. Now we will look at this and we'll go, right, if the right decision is this for the e-commerce experience and it's going to have a detrimental impact on the store, we're still going to do it. And this team's job is going to be to mitigate that detrimental impact as much as possible. But culturally, that was quite a big change for us. You know, we don't see ourselves, as I said, we don't see the store now as sort of the overlord of the business, if you like.
Right.
So I work with the e-commerce team a lot. You know, we have about 20, just over 20 people whose role is purely e-commerce focused. So looking at the technology and looking at the content that's on the site. And we work with, you know, we have 2 or 3 external IT partners and, you know, software partners that we work with. And so I suppose I probably, that's another big part of my role, is talking to these people, trying to, I don't really understand the technology, so I don't get too sucked into why something can't do something. Right. I just go, but I want it to do something. So just come on. So I think I you know, I try to sort of strive and get that team thinking about, you know, kind of what can we do? And I make silly videos, you know, so I'm still here 5 days a week, you know, and they're, I work, you know, fairly hard. I mean, not hard in the sense of a way someone digging holes has to work, you know, but
right.
I think if I had to say, what would I love to feel I could do? What's the worst thing about my role? I tell you the worst thing about my role, and I bet everyone that's got their own business will agree with this, is never being able to switch off. So holidays, I'm, you know, I don't dedicate enough time to my family. You know, I'm always checking an email or all this usual shit that, you know, I wish I could literally go. I go to bed at night, wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning going, what about this? And what about that? What about this? What about that? And I hate it. I absolutely hate that fact. And the older I get, I think the more I go, come on, you've really, really got to try and work out how to deal with this. But I also accept that that's probably part of the reason it's been successful.
Mm-hmm.
So
I did that exact same thing just this morning. As a matter of fact, I'd had this really detailed dream about trying to reach out and talk to a competitor, because I have this idea of I want to have my strongest, longest, localist competitor on this podcast. And we don't really have a great relationship, but I want one. I've always wanted to have a good relationship with them. They've never wanted to have it. And I think it's because, you know, they are of a size that if it wasn't for me, they're like the big star in their solar system. They would have cleared out all the debris and they would have this to themselves. And here I am kind of mucking it up, you know? And so I think that that's why. And so in my dream, like, I'm going on this long journey to try to find the CEO of this company to talk to them about, like, being on my podcast. And it was extremely detailed. And then I woke up from that thinking, like, well, that was really weird. And then that just got me thinking about all this. So here it is, literally 4 a.m. And from 4 till 6:30 in the morning, I'm just kind of laying in bed thinking about business, thinking about other things, and drift off to sleep for about an hour and then get back up. So I can totally relate, and I'm sure many of us can. But you're right, a lot of those times, I don't know that that conversation was particularly useful for anything I'm going to do with the business, but there are times where I solve, or I think I solve things. There's times too when it, you know, later with a clear head, I think through and go, I don't know that that was that great of an idea. But I've certainly had many brilliant ideas in the middle of the night like that, that just kind of occur to you. The solution just finally, you know, presents itself.
I'm not sure that I've ever solved anything by lying awake at night worrying about it, which is probably the worst. Like, you know, if I was solving things, I don't think I'd feel so bad about lying about them. But I just don't think I do. It's just so, I think a few ideas, you know, sort of interesting. I think maybe less so when I'm asleep, but even into the night, and you just go, oh, just, there's an idea, you know, I don't know. It's just, but what do you do? It is what it is, isn't it? You know, the business is what it is because of the effort that myself and all the other people involved have put into it. And sometimes, you know, you just, it's not a tap you can just turn on and off. It's just like a constant flow sometimes, isn't it? And it is difficult to just go. I think I feel worse for my family, you know, in the sense of I've got two young kids growing up, and I can literally picture them both now going, daddy, daddy, are you listening to what we're saying? Can you stop looking at your phone? You know,
right. No, I totally get that. You know, I think fortunately my kids are understanding of it, and my oldest is 19, and he's actually now, like, just like you, he's working in the shop.
I hope he's on minimum wage with a mop and
that he
appreciates it.
He started when he was probably 12 or 13, which is the age of my youngest. And he started in our, the oldest started in our repair facility, and obviously not doing repair, but literally with a mop and a broom and just doing those types of tasks and projects. And so he would just work during the summer, and we'd pay him half of minimum wage or something like that, just cash, you know, and he probably wasn't even worth that sometimes, but he got better as he got older. But even, you know, even at that age, I would tell him, like, you know, bud, like, if you end up wanting to pursue this, and I've always told my kids, they don't have to do this. If they don't want to, they can do something else. And it's totally fine with me. I don't have like some dream that someday my sons will work with me. But it's like, you know, if you end up doing this, like some of these people that are here today could end up working with you and for you at some point. Like, so you have to start building your reputation now. I know that seems crazy to tell you that at 13, but like, you're going to start building their memories and perceptions of you right now. And he's done a pretty good job with that. And he, now that he's working on the sales floor in the store here in Springfield, you know, he's doing a good job there. I think he's, I wrote down a few of the things you were saying when you started. I think he kind of follows that same mindset. He doesn't throw his surname around. Like you said, he tries to keep it pretty humble about what he's doing. And he's, you know, sincerely interested in the business and what happens.
I mean, my girls are, you know, they're 3 and 7, two daughters, 3 and 7. So we're a long way away from talking about succession planning. yes, I'm sure.
It's going to be tricky getting to the fourth generation. I mean, the third generation, second and third generation is tricky enough, you know, and you'll have to just see what kind of desire and interest they have. You know, I was just speaking about my sons because I felt like it's made them more understanding about why I kind of work a lot. But they also see some flexibility with what I do, because I do tend to work 6 or 7 days a week, but I don't tend to work 8 to 12 hours a day. It just kind of depends. And my youngest, who for the longest time has never shown any interest in being in the business. We had a new friend over about a month ago who owns a music store a few hours away, and they were visiting. And so they were at our home, and we were sitting outside on the deck having a cocktail, and my youngest comes out, and these new friends are asking him, "So are you going to be a part of the business someday?" And to my utter surprise, my youngest son, Maddox, said, "Yep. Yep." And I immediately was like, "Hold up. Like, what? Like, that's never been said before." So, you know, I think that helps when they understand. But yeah, I totally get it. We are sacrificing a lot to build our businesses, and we're sacrificing some family times and things like that. But I don't know that we know any other way to do it.
Right.
I think it's the only way we're driven to do it. And I think it's the only way we know how to do it to be successful.
Yeah.
With the YouTube channel, I would just imagine, so the YouTube channel has over 700,000 subscribers and nearly 3,000 videos. And for anyone who's not maybe active on YouTube or YouTuber themselves, I have a couple of different YouTube channels. And I know, like, so if I have 700,000 subscribers, I likely have millions of viewers, regular viewers, because most regular viewers don't subscribe. They just see the videos. So
the subscriber count is quite an out of date metric, I think, now for your sort of success on YouTube, because YouTube doesn't really push people hard to subscribe anymore. Even people who are subscribed don't necessarily get notifications about new videos going up anymore. Certainly the way things work on mobile is very different to desktop. And what YouTube wants you to watch isn't what you've told YouTube you want to watch. YouTube wants you to watch what it thinks you will watch for the longest, so that it can play as many adverts to you as possible. So it doesn't necessarily follow the old fashioned YouTube algorithm, which is if you've subscribed to a certain channel, YouTube assumes you'll want to watch that. And so that's what they'll serve you up. It doesn't really work like that anymore. So, I mean, we have a phenomenally wide range of views on videos. So we can have some videos that 7 or 8,000 people watch. We can have other videos that 250,000 people watch. And I'm not sure that I've, unfortunately, I think we're slightly out of control of that, because what pretty much dictates how many people watch a video is what the... No, actually, I'll take that back. We obviously are in control of what we're filming, and to a certain degree what people will watch. But because I've never really wanted Andertons to go down a sort of a particularly comedic route or educational route, I've always felt that, you know, our roots are in product demonstrations. You know, it's like it's product demonstrations and then hopefully some comedy or some education as part of that. But it's not like some big YouTube channels where it's comedy for the sake of comedy or education for the sake of education. And so I think what dictates how many views many of our videos get is just how interesting is the product that we're demonstrating. So we, some of my favorite, funniest, best videos that I think we've ever done might just be on a pretty, you know, sort of niche, not very interesting product, and it doesn't, and therefore that video doesn't get very many views. And then you can do another video which is, you know, of a product of huge interest, and you might look at it and go, I didn't think the video was a particularly outstanding one, but it might have 500,000 views because 500,000 people were interested in that product. So I don't think to a certain extent that I'm uncomfortable. That doesn't really, I don't think we try and break that, if that's the right word. You know, I don't think there's any sense that we're trying to only do videos on mass interest product, or, you know, I think, you know, we try and we're just, I honestly do think one of the reasons we're relatable to is fundamentally, we're still just as excited about the new products coming out as all the people who are buying them are. So sure. When a new range of pedals come out that we think are super, super cool, even though it might be the tiniest boutique company, we might only sell 5 of those pedals. We're super excited about doing that video. Same as we're maybe super excited about doing, I don't know, like an Acoustasonic video where, you know, you might sell 250 guitars off of the back of it or something.
Right.
And I think that's important that you, I'm not going to name any names, but there are a lot, well, not a lot. There are a few YouTube channels out there in our circle who are so serious about it all. You know, it's just like, it's like, oh my God, there's like, there's zero sense of fun or humor, or, you know, it's like, why did you even learn to play guitar if it wasn't for fun? You know, it's just like, come on, smile. You know, it's not all about, you know, it's, maybe there are some customers out there that to them, the whole thing's terribly serious and they relate to those kind of videos, but
I'm sure there are. I think it's actually probably not a bad strategy. I mean, if everyone's zigging, if one person will zag, you can have a nice little business off of that. And
yeah, you're probably right. But for me, and for all, you know, everyone either that's into guitar, at the heart of it all, it's for the love and for fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's and I think I'm hoping that, you know, that's, you know, I'm hoping that when we make videos that comes across, that, and that's hopefully why it's relatable, and you know, we'll carry on making videos that are fun as long as people want to watch them, and probably long after as well, just because they are fun.
Do you participate in any of YouTube's monetization for your videos?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. It's a real fun. This is quite interesting. I don't want people to get the sort of the wrong idea about me. I'm not naturally a greedy person. I don't have aspirations to have a yacht and, you know, 3 houses and all that kind of stuff. But it does, I look at our YouTube content. Now, about 85% of the people who watch our YouTube content don't live in the UK. And as a result of that, it's quite difficult for them to buy anything from us. Well, not difficult mm-hmm. is the wrong word, but it doesn't make much sense that they would buy something from us.
It's more expensive. Yeah.
Yep. Shipping and after sales service becomes more of a challenge, language barriers, all that kind of stuff. So I kind of sit and go, well, that's kind of, there's 85% of the people watching my videos that are just getting a free ride, you know, as I said, I don't care. Except that something inside me does care. It's just a bit weird. So yes, we monetize the videos. Yes, we've just started a subscription service. So there is now a thing called Anderton's Extra, there's a beta version of it up now, but perhaps by the time this podcast comes out, it'll be in its full glory, which is essentially somewhere where you can pay to watch. It's a tiny, like $2 or $3 a month, but you can pay to watch our YouTube videos with no adverts in them. Plus there is extra content. So there's like another 20 odd videos a month that go up that you can't see for free on YouTube. You know, yes, we're starting to get into digital downloads. So we'll be creating all of our own patches for products like Boss Katana and THR and Kemper. And, you know, so there is mm-hmm. this idea that much as I do love doing these videos, I do look at it and go, it's probably costing me £250,000 a year to make the videos. You know, mm-hmm. when you look at salaries and rent and the equipment that you buy and all this kind of stuff. So there is part of me that just goes, I don't feel guilty about monetizing it. people, sure. And at the end of the day, absolutely everything we sell is non-essential. So if you don't want it, because you don't want to pay for it, it's like, that's fine as well. So I don't know. It's funny that, isn't it? There must be somewhere in the back of me, this sort of grounding capitalist that just sees a business opportunity and goes, well, it's there, so I should try, right? But I don't know that I'm naturally, there's also another part of me that does feel a bit, I don't know, am I that person? Well, there you go. Now you've got me on a psychiatrist's couch now, sort of going, why? I don't know why. I don't need to do it. I don't need to do it financially. You know, the Andertons, the 15% of people watching the YouTube channel that do shop with us create an amazing business for us that gives me a comfortable living and employs 150 odd people. And, it's a good business. But yeah, there's obviously, I guess, if there's an opportunity there to try and do something for the other 85% of people who are watching and might want to spend $2 or $3 a month with us, then I suppose I'll give it a try and see what happens.
Sure. Well, I think some of it's the challenge of doing it and the challenge to see like what kind of support, how do people really value this content that we're doing? Do they value it enough where they would pay a nominal fee for it? And there's a curiosity to wonder what that is. Like, sure, they're watching it because it's free, but would they want to watch? Do they want to watch more by paying? I'm curious. I want to know that. And I could totally see that being a driving factor just in, the curiosity of it.
One of the things that, again, I don't want to go to manufacturers and say, look, 1 million people have watched this video, or maybe not 1 million, that's probably, 100,000 people have watched this video. That's 85,000 people not in the UK. So if I know that I've sold 20 of these units as a direct result of doing that video to people in the UK, I'm guessing that worldwide you've sold another 100 of these to customers. So there's part of me that wants to say, so where's my slice of that, please?
Right.
But unfortunately, the reality is I also want to retain my integrity and my editorial integrity. And the minute that you cross that line, because a supplier goes, okay, well, I'll pay you $2,000 to make that next video or fight or whatever it is, then all of a sudden you're going, well, hang on a second, is that an advert now? Because I don't want it to be an advert. I think we just accept that we can't look to the supply side to fund the videos, because then I'm just selling my soul to the devil. And a massive percentage of the people who watch the videos for free will never buy anything from us, for a multitude of reasons. And I guess I've just got to accept that. I mean, it is mad. I sit on my phone at night, probably being evilly stared at by my wife, answering questions from people all around the world going, I saw this deal on eBay for this. Should I buy it? Or there's this, what was last night? I got that pedal from Sweetwater that you recommended. What's a good pair of speakers to go with it? And I suppose I'm sort of going, okay, I suppose I should answer, because it's like you've asked.
But right.
Equally, is it my, I don't know, not is it my place to I don't know, that's a difficult one. If it, all the time it's 2 or 3 people a day asking a question, it's not too bad. If it was 20 or 30 people a day, I think I'd have to take a harder line of just going, look, are you going to buy this from Andertons? Because right. If you're not, I'm not answering the question,
Right.
It's mad. It is mad.
Nobody would blame you for that, for sure. I mean,
some people would. Have you never read the YouTube comments section?
Nobody, that's true. No, I don't. I don't read the YouTube comments. No, that's so different. I mean, I do occasionally, but very rarely. And it's somewhat like reading the Facebook comments for my local newspaper. My local newspaper will post a story, and then every once in a while, because I guess I'm just a glutton for punishment, I'll read the comments and lose all respect and faith in my community. So
mankind, I try generally. Not to. Yeah. No, you know what? It's that's a that's another one. If anybody's watching this and thinking, you know, I quite like the idea of promoting my business over YouTube or whatever, it's like that, man, you need a thick skin.
Yeah.
And, but I tell you the advice I would give is just treat the comments section as if 100 people watch your video, chances are probably 2 people will comment, and they're either going to be in the 1% of the nicest people ever, who just are just the sweetest people on the planet, and they're the 1 in 100 like that, or they're the opposite. They're like the most horrible, scummy, nasty person that you'd never want to meet. And even if you did, you wouldn't be friends with them like that.
Yeah.
And so therefore, all you're seeing in the comments section is the super extremes of humanity, like the craziest, nicest people and the craziest, horriblest people. That's and the true. 98% of normal, like the ones in the middle, who chances are what, where all your friends, all the human beings in the world that actually mean anything to you, are probably in that 98%. They never comment. So don't worry about it. You know, it's like, do not take any stock, good or bad, from what it said in the comments section. Otherwise you are, sooner or later, you're just going to drive yourself insane.
Right. Well, and it's so easy today to start. I think it's easier today to start than it was when you started your channel, because
you think?
I think in terms of the technology required.
Oh, for sure.
It's harder to get noticed, but when you started the channel, you'd have to have all this separate equipment. Mm. And today, I mean, honestly, all of our phones can produce, good quality video. Interfaces are so inexpensive. Heck, even the microphones on our newest phones are pretty decent. I'm always shocked about the audio quality I can get just off the mic off the phone. But interfaces are affordable. Lighting's affordable.
Yeah, like, but it's just, honestly, I would disagree in the sense that, you know, the first 5 years of Anderton's making video was just on the crappiest equipment, and the quality was crap and the audio was crap, but it didn't matter because the content was good. So I would say to anybody, I mean, number one, now I do think YouTube is done. It's like, unless you've got that, I mean, what do you call it? Unless you've got that unicorn idea, it's like the chances are a million people have already done what you're thinking of doing on YouTube. And that's why I think now it's like, had we not been an early adopter, I don't think we'd have got the traction, to do it. So I think you are nowadays going, what new platforms are there? But I think now social media just generally is such an insane amount of, TikTok can come along, and it's like, whereas YouTube maybe took 5-10 years before it became like as big as it is, TikTok just goes boom, 100 miles an hour straight away, millions of people on it. And if you're like 5 minutes late to the party, then you ain't coming in.
Right.
And you're almost looking like, so what's the next one? What's the next one? So I don't know. I mean, I can't think of any channels on YouTube that haven't had a really unique angle to come at this from and been successful. You know, any other music store, for example, that's just come across, they go, well, we'll just get our guy to sit in front of a camera and tell you about a guitar that's come out this week. You know, it's so done. It's like nobody's, I mean, I guess if you're a Toman or a Sweetwater or whatever, and you want to start doing something like that, and you can afford to say, yeah, we're going to throw $1 million at it every year until we are a player, then
right.
I'm sure money buys traction. If you want to throw enough at it, but no, I think for everyone else now, I think it is about going, find the opportunity that is there rather than just jumping on the same bandwagon that everybody else is on.
I think it's relative. I think there's certainly many retailers that be listening today. If they're doing $1 million in revenue each year, they could likely, I mean, the nice thing about YouTube is the content's more evergreen. Mm-hmm. So someone goes to search for something, a video from a couple of years ago can pop up and it could be relevant. You could still sell that product or similar products today, and it's very helpful. And it's really the only platform that has that kind of content. TikTok could be a great way if you're trying to just sort of make an impression and do something quickly right now. But it's very, it's like Facebook. It's just, it's here and it's gone. Almost nobody searches for anything. The TikTok algorithm is exceptional. It's probably the best algorithm, I think, on social media in terms of finding the stuff you like and sending it to you. Like, it's exceptional.
I started a TikTok page about 6 weeks ago, and just, I was so appalled by the level of content that I was being served up. You know, just as in, wow, if this is honestly what humanity wants to watch, then shoot me now. And I just, that's it. I never went back. So I've got this TikTok page that I've not put anything on because I'm just too embarrassed. It's too far. It's, you know, there we go. There's the old man in me.
I'm going to feel felt found you. Okay. So I know how you feel. I felt the same way, but what I found is that by interacting with it more, searching for things I was interested in, following, liking, the algorithm got pretty dialed into what I was interested in, and the quality got better. I had it on my phone twice. The first time I put it on, I watched it. I was like, this is terrible. I had the same exact feeling you did and deleted it. I was like, this is just dumb. And then maybe 6 months or so later, I can't remember what, but I got back on it again because I'd heard someone say, hey, you know, I felt this way, but I actually found there's some great creators and stuff like that on there. And you're right. There's a lot. I think a lot of people get on TikTok because there's you know, short, funny things that are on there. There's beautiful people on there revealing everything they can reveal without having to have an OnlyFans account. Usually they're doing that to promote their OnlyFans account or whatever. And so I think a lot of people kind of get on that, but then eventually you drift over and start finding like your hobbies and your interests and so on and so forth. So I think it's an opportunity, but it's, again, it's so in the moment, and you have to have your probably e-commerce business set up in a way where if someone's like, that's really cool, I want to hit their link tree and go buy this product, where they're set up to do that. I don't know that we know what the next thing is to take the place of YouTube. I don't know. We still find success with YouTube with the things that I use it for, but you're right. It's, I think also my expectations of it are not the same thing of what your expectations would be for it, you know? And there's certainly, I'm sure, videos that you've done where you feel like, that wasn't that great. The results weren't that great. It wasn't, you know, the juice wasn't worth the squeeze for Andertons, but that some music store that's doing $350,000 a year in turnover would be like, I would love that. I would love to take that. So it's kind of all relative. Yeah. And who knows what the next thing's going to be, but you're right. YouTube is, it's saturated.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose we bought a Peloton during lockdown. It's like, holy moly, is that a clever combination of a physical product and a digital product in one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's, I mean, again, that's not something that a retailer is going to be able to roll out without hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of investment, you know, seed investment. But I guess, I don't know. I think you, but I would still go. If you want to dive into YouTube and you just feel like it's just going to be me sitting on a sofa talking about the guitars that have just been delivered to my store, do it for love, not because you think it's going to go anywhere, because then it's just a nice surprise if it does go somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think I'm got a bit of a downer on it, but I just when that Fender Acoustasonic came out, you know, the Jazzmaster Acoustasonic, mm-hmm. and Fender carpet bombed the internet with Acoustasonic promo for like 24 hours, didn't they? Mm-hmm. And honestly, I'm scrolling through because I'm looking at our video and seeing where it's ranking, and oh, this person got more, and da da da. How? What did they do? And as I'm scrolling down, I'm going, this guy here's got one view. You know, it's like this guy here's got three views. It's like, wow, that's brutal. That was probably right. Him literally watching the video twice just to make sure the audio was okay. You know, it's just like it's just brutal. So yeah, I don't know, man. I'm still think it's you know, look for some uniqueness. And yeah, be, you know, try and, you know, be yourself and be unique.
Even with your e-commerce content, it helps because it gives you, if nothing else, you have a video hosting platform that you can post review videos on it and then link to your e-commerce page. So, and if you happen to hit lightning and actually get something further than that, then lucky you. So, so last couple of questions. You're right. We didn't get to anything else, but which is great though, because I really love the stuff that we talked about today, but I do tend to like to ask these questions all the time. So tell me about a negative situation that you have experienced in your business career that ultimately ended up having a positive effect on your business, but you wouldn't want to repeat it again.
I'm not a terribly confrontational person. So I know that if I need to change something and it's going to create some confrontation in order to change that, I will typically shy away from it for longer than I probably should. And I certainly think there is always a huge sense of relief after you've done it that makes you sit and think, I can't believe I put off doing this for 3 months or 6 months or whatever. And the number of nights I didn't sleep properly because I worried about it. And it's, you know, if you've, but I don't know, that's, I don't, and I don't want to go into specific examples of what that would have been, because normally they involve other people and, you know, that's sure. Fine. I just like, I love the fact that I've managed to employ lots of other people to do all the negative things. I really don't want to feel like I'm dodging that question, but I think it is just about saying, look, you know, when you sometimes, you know, sometimes you've put something together and you've put a team of people together and you're working a team and there's just something doesn't feel right. And you feel like you need to do something about it and you know, it's going to be awful and confrontational. And, but that would be my only thing. It's my experience right from, you know, even going back, it's like the buildup and the stress and the tension of not doing it is always worse than the sort of aftermath of doing it.
Yeah. So yeah.
That's hopefully some sort of advice if you put that into some sort of context.
I think we've all been there and we've all experienced that. And, you know, you're right. There's things we should have acted sooner and should have addressed it. I think the main thing, you just want to handle it with, you know, with care and kindness when dealing with those situations when they come up. You know, how would you want to be treated if you're on the other end? And try to handle them that way. And we could all be faster at it, I think.
Yeah.
So the last question is, if you could send a message to yourself 10 years ago, bit of business advice or business wisdom, what would you tell the younger you? And I'll say 10 years, but it could be anything. You could pick 20 years.
I think this potentially goes back to my college or disastrous time at college. I'm absolutely rubbish at taking advice from anyone else. And I mean that in, it's like, I just need to do stuff and work it out for myself. Like if it, you know, I'm just, and I actually, funnily enough, I think some of it is, I actually think that if ADHD had been a diagnosis when I was younger, I think my very short attention span to most things would probably have been diagnosed as that. So I don't feel necessarily in a way, you know, what I think the way my brain sparks is it does have lots of, it does have quite, you know, it's constantly thinking about things and ideas coming out, and therefore I have very low boredom threshold. So I fidget a lot, and if I'm not really, really engaged, I'll just zone out. Zoom calls, if it's not a one-to-one, if I'm not the subject in a Zoom call and two other people on the Zoom call start talking, absolutely guarantee you, if after 5 minutes they go, what do you think, Lee, I'll be like, no, oh, shit, I literally haven't listened to anything they've said for the last 4 minutes. So maybe I should maybe that would be some advice, but there's nothing I can do about that. That's just how I am, you know. It's just so I don't, do you know what? I mean, it's, I don't think I would give this advice to my younger self, but I'm definitely trying to give this advice to my current self, which is, I do, I'm just going to sound a bit up myself, I think, a bit here, but I think I'm going to try and do a bit more for, you know, the community and people around me. And, you know, I don't want to pull that sort of whole, you know, charity, like, you know, I'm going to do these amazing things. But we did get involved about 2 or 3 years ago. Actually, there's probably a longer story to that. I was at the NAMM Awards in 2018 at Summer NAMM, and it was the big one where we'd won the Dealer of the Year award. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was like big deal. And it was the first award ceremony I'd ever been to in person. And one of the categories was for doing something good in your community. It had a much catchier name than that, but it was.
Yeah.
And they ran some video of 3 or 4 businesses that had been nominated. One had done some stuff with kids with autism. And there was the dealer that won it was an Australian dealer who'd put this music festival on for these people who lived on this island that couldn't get back to the mainland to, you know, it was like, and it was just like, oh man, there's so much more to this than just selling guitars and counting the numbers at the end of every day, you know, and going.
Right.
So I came back to the UK and thought, I don't necessarily have a, you know, I've been very fortunate. Nothing really tragic has ever happened to me in my life. So there's not necessarily, I don't have necessarily a sense of a connection with a particular charity or not. But one of the charities in this country that's very well supported by the music industry is called Teenage Cancer Trust. And it's a charity that, so if you're diagnosed with cancer in this country, obviously we've got our wonderful National Health Service. So, you know, everybody, no matter what, you know, background you're from, has access to the same treatment, but it splits you into a pediatric ward. So if you're under, I think it's under 18 or 19 years old, you're going to a pediatric ward. And if you're over 18 or 19 years old, you go into an adult ward. Mm-hmm. And the pediatric wards are really geared up for very young children. So, you know, you've got like Lego play sets and dolls and little play areas and stuff like that. And equally, the adult wards are sadly for a lot of sort of palliative care, you know, where people are just very old and in the final stages of life.
Right.
So Teenage Cancer Trust is a purely charity funded group of people that work inside the NHS to go and create these wards that are dedicated for people between the age of, I think, 14 and 20. Three, something like that. And it's all about going, look, the NHS is there to provide the care, but all, you know, if you're in for weeks and weeks having your treatment, let's have like a music studio or some computer games or like a pool table or just like a different vibe, an area where you can go and hang out and everyone else is going to be roughly a similar age. So you're not in there with very young kids or, you know, elderly. Anyway, so it was very well supported by the music industry over here. Roger Daltrey is a patron. They do a big gig at the Royal Albert Hall every year, and which they haven't been able to do for the last couple of years, obviously. But, and I just thought, well, I'll go and inquire. So I got in touch with them and said, I'm interested in doing some fundraising. You, can we meet up? And I went to one of the centers at a local hospital here. And it's like immediately you walk in and your little bubble of life is good is burst and you're going, shit man, life is just outside of my little bubble of awareness. It's just, there's all these, and I know there's probably a million other charities looking after people who are similarly having a tough time, but I don't know, I just couldn't, it was just impossible not to sit and see, you know, these unbelievably inspiring teenage kids who are faced with the news, you know, the crappiest news that no one really, whatever age you are, no one wants to hear those words, do they? And I just felt like the charity was small enough. They have 28 centers up and down the UK. The charity was small enough that I felt that I could make a difference, you know. So I felt, you know, you can, so the first couple of things we did was just like write off 10 guitars and just say, look, can we put this in one of the centers so that at least they've got some guitars or some keyboards or whatever.
Right.
And we tried to do a bit more. And earlier this year, we did our biggest ever fundraising event for Teenage Cancer Trust, did a big raffle of loads of stuff that we'd had in the video studio, and we sold tickets all around the world. And we raised about $150,000 for the trust. And it's just a sense that I do feel like, and you know, this isn't advice I would given to me 10 years ago. This is almost advice for me for the next 10 years. It's like, mm-hmm. I sort of feel like there's nothing else really that matters to me that I need to prove anymore. You know, it's like, you know, I've become, you know, the business has been successful. The YouTube thing's been successful. I think most people within the music industry would look at Anderton's and go, yeah, that's a well-run business. And, you know, not the biggest, but not the smallest, you know. And so I don't feel like I've got, you know, I do feel like there's more important things to leave behind now and do than selling more guitars or being a bigger Fender dealer or whatever. And I'd love to think that everybody, you know, could look around them and hopefully somebody like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos will save the planet. But I don't think I'm quite, you know, I haven't quite got that sort of leverage. But I hopefully, you know, I think I can do some good in this bit, you know, and hopefully everyone else, or, you know, hopefully lots of other people will go, well, yeah, I think I could probably do some good in this bit as well, or that bit, or whichever bit it is. And I find that probably the most, that's probably the most rewarding thing I've right now at the moment. I'm, you know, feeling like, and I've got to get the balance right, because I can't, you know, the business, you know, there's 150 odd people relying on getting paid at the end of every month. And it's similarly, you know, I don't think I'm necessarily talking about going, yep, but just give it all away and get, but I think there's a balance to be done of having a successful business and having a side project that does some good in the community that I want to sort of do a bit more of. Anyway, crikey, I don't want, you know, so I said, I'm not trying to say support Teenage Cancer Trust or isn't Anderton's amazing. It's more a question of just going, I think if everybody just tried, and obviously hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people around the world already do. But I think if everyone just went, I'm sure there's something. It definitely, if you're in MI and you're a member of NAMM and you can go and look at those historical video reels of the awards ceremony every year, just watch the category about the ones who do good in community. It's really uplifting and really inspiring. They're the people I think that deserve. I said to the NAMM show, I don't even think dealer of the year should be the award you give out at the end. I think dealer that did something in their community should be the award that is the prestige award. But hey, that's just, again, me being old and soppy, I think.
But it's such a good point, though, for all of us to challenge ourselves with that. To our businesses have given us so much that we should be grateful and try to give back as well. And I think that's also good business, to be honest with you. I think our community will love our businesses even more when they see that we care and that we're supporting the people in our community that need support. It's not an area I've been particularly good at over the years. We've always contributed to stuff and things like that, but you just do it because, like, you know, you do it. But lately, over the kind of like you in the last year, I've had a few conversations with people that kind of have a heart for that. And it's awakened me to how I should be looking at that differently than what I had before. And certainly our conversation today is kind of reminding me that it's time to get going on that. Mm. You know, it's time to start doing something. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be six-figure donation for something. If you can do it, great. But it could be something as simple as food drives. It could be something as simple as free lessons for students. It could be any kind of activity.
I think that's where, again, although I know the trust that we support employs lots of staff and it's got monthly overheads, and you know, and I'm sure a lot of that money that we've raised, the big money that we've raised, will just simply go to keeping the charity going. But at a much lower level, I could literally have just dropped two guitars in to one of the centers and that would make a difference.
Yeah.
You know, you can't tell me that there aren't two guitars sitting in your store that have been there for ages, and to be fair, you're just going, whatever.
I'm just glad to not have to see them anymore.
Yeah. And you know, we're not giving away Les Pauls and custom shop Strats. You know, we're just giving away like relatively entry level acoustic guitars. And you know, I just think it's just little small things is what makes the difference. And again, do it because you've found somewhere that means something to you, rather than, you know, I'm just doing my tax return and I need, my accountant says I'd be better off if I just made a 50,000 donation to somewhere here. Okay. I mean, that's amazing as well, but it's not really, I think it's not the same. Anyway, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Do it for the part of your heart that has care and compassion.
Well, that's a wrap for this episode. If you'd like help with your business, check out musicretailconsulting.com for articles, resources, and coaching and consulting services. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast so you're aware of future updates, and rate and review while you're at it. Thanks for listening.